This week on Your Western Context, a new economic doctrine emerges from Chrystia Freeland. New changes abound in the BC municipal elections, and Alberta Premier Danielle Smith names her new cabinet. Also, Trudeau asserts that demand for Canadian oil will decrease reliance on it. This is Western Context, episode 291, recorded Saturday, October 22nd, 2022. Words and actions. Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Western Context. Patrick and myself are here as we are each and every week, and this week has proven to be quite the busy news week in Canada. We had a whole boatload of stories that we had to pare down, but nonetheless, we have arrived at the end, and we have a selection of stories that represent the best and most traditional of what Western Context stands for.
Yes, this past week it just proves that a lifetime can happen within a week in politics, and there were certainly dozens of stories that we could have talked about this week, but there are plenty of news out there, and certainly a lot that didn't get covered quite correctly in the way that it should have been by the mainstream media in covering all of the angles and what that actually means to ordinary Canadians and the future. And I think that's why we've got the stories we have this week and why we are covering them and why we do what we do here at Western Context.
That's right. And if you're joining us for the first time, Western Context is a podcast that goes through the news of the week in Canada with, of course, a Western focus as per the name. And what we aim to do with all that is remove the media bias and sensationalism that you find, whether it be from online, your newspapers, on TV, practically anywhere you get your news, even social media too. Lots of bias there, lots of sensationalism there. And in removing that, we hope to provide all the information and context necessary to put you, our listeners, on the right side of the news. And if you want to follow along, we have full show notes available at westerncontext.ca. And we're going to begin with one of our Canada stories this week, something that should be drawing a little bit more attention than it is, the so-called Freeland Doctrine. And much hay has been made, of course, about how the Trudeau government has taken a climate-first approach in all layers of government, from budgeting to foreign policy and beyond. And this is something we even saw at the international treaty stage with the government's failed attempt to make a free trade deal with China, when anybody who had the knowledge of how global affairs actually works would know that the free trade deal that would have been made with China would have actually benefited China more so than Canada. But in the end, China backed down because of our demands for climate assurances in the deal. Now, the government has also been ripe with vigor whenever it could oppose and show the world that it was the obvious foil to Donald Trump's administration. And this is something that we saw from 2016 all through Donald Trump's presidency. Now, the government got to do this for a long time, but now we're starting to see the cracks that this idealism may be ending, at least from one side of the government. And we're going to talk specifically about Finance Minister and Deputy Prime Minister Chrystia Freeland, who gave a speech to the Brookings Institute in Washington, D.C. And when you look at this policy speech, it amounts to a huge change in foreign policy and budgetary policy for Canada. Now, Freeland, of course, herself is the Finance Minister and Deputy Prime Minister. And we haven't, of course, heard if there's going to be a shift on the foreign affairs file from Foreign Affairs Minister Melanie Joly, but the words spoken by Freeland implied that there's going to be many things that might change, which will become apparent as we move through this story, and if they're all to be implemented by the Government of Canada, it would amount to a huge turn in policy over the last 35 years. Now, the policy calls for the government to stop supporting autocracies and dictatorships, and it specifically highlights Russia, but of course many other countries fall into this realm. And looking deeper into what Chrystia Freeland says, this also means ceasing a reliance on Russian energy and Chinese manufacturing. Now, for people who are unaware, Canada only imports a tiny amount of oil from Russia, but others, mainly in Europe, import far more, and we of course could do our own bit by stopping the oil that we do import and stopping imports from other conflict regimes like Venezuela, and the Middle East. Now, of course, we'll have to see if this is also included in Freeland's new doctrine, because that would put a spotlight on the oil that comes out of Canada. Now, it was only at the beginning of the pandemic, of course, that it was decried as racist to want to decouple from China and manufacture at home. And of course, this is largely because this is what President Trump was saying at the time, and as such, the media had to go against it, and because Justin Trudeau and his government were the foil to the Trump administration, his government went against it too, but that might be changing as we move forward. Speaking to workers at a green hydrogen plant in Quebec, Chrystia Freeland said that this change represents an economic opportunity for Canada, an opportunity which occurs only once per generation. Now, peeling back the layers of the quote, of course, we see hydrogen and whatnot, and that raises a lot of other questions about nuclear, wind, solar, and of course the fossil fuel industry in Canada. But if we're to be serious about decoupling from conflict regimes of energy, it also means that Canada needs to export more LNG, otherwise known as liquefied natural gas, and oil needs to be able to be exported through our ports to countries that want to buy it. And if you look back to 2015, this government hasn't enabled this yet. So it's going to be very interesting to see whether or not the government of Canada that Chrystia Freeland is a part of, led by Prime Minister Trudeau, is going to enable that and change policy based on what Chrystia Freeland is saying, or if this is just Chrystia Freeland postulating her own ideas out there, which could get interesting, and we'll touch on that in a little bit at the end of the story. The policy also includes investment in tech, with Nokia in Canada becoming what they want to call Silicon Valley North. The deal will pursue research and development with Nokia. And this is interesting because it was only earlier this year that the government was still being pushed to ban Huawei from our 5G infrastructure, which they later did ban. The new vision also includes a shift on trade tied to the American sphere of influence, saying that if we are to tie our economies even more closely together, we must be more confident that we all follow the rules in trade with each other, and even especially when it would be easier not to. And this is, of course, a nod to some of the protectionism that has cropped up in the Biden administration, let alone the Trump administration. Now, this means, of course, anybody in this sphere would be following the values of America First, with Canada contributing where we can, bringing the two economies of Canada and the U.S. closer together by pursuing values that would put us ahead compared to the autocracies that were mentioned by Chrystia Freeland. Now, this was a policy that you would never have imagined coming in from the Trudeau government while the former administration was in power, because it's a lot closer to what the Trump administration and Biden administration want to do than what the Obama administration did, the Bush administration, Clinton administration, and many governments of Canada going back to the 1980s and earlier. Now, with that, this, of course, raises many, many interesting questions about what we can expect going forward. But at the end of the day, it's all very nice and well put, but you have to look at what was actually happening with this and realize that no energy projects were approved that would actually enable us to pursue this policy. And that's the real head scratcher behind this. The policy also includes typical neoliberal angles as well, such as deepening and expanding NATO. The policy showcases a concerted effort among democracies to mirror NATO's discipline economically in terms of the supply chain and to build those up so that they would run through each other country's economy. And then the policy would also need to get countries in Africa, Latin America, and the Caribbean on board and hope that they would ultimately choose the right side. What we have here is Chrystia Freeland effectively promoting a form of economic nationalism that would be supported by NATO allies and friends. And this is a pivot from the calls of globalism that have driven trade and foreign policy in the last 35 years. It's an admission that with tweaks, the core ideas of the likes of Donald Trump and Brexit UK have merit. But Freeland, Biden, and others won't tell you this up front, even though that's what they're pursuing. if this is successful, it represents a huge opportunity to set forth a new global alliance. But of course, there might be a stumbling block. And that stumbling block comes to the fact that what Chrystia Freeland is saying hasn't exactly been told by the Canadian government when she is a minister and a deputy prime minister in this government. She doesn't ultimately set the course of the government. We have to wait and see what Justin Trudeau ultimately decides on. There's also the fact that such an agreement would likely ruffle the feathers of the NDP, the Liberals' confidence and supply partner. And of course, the other option is this, is that Freeland is spreading her own wings and becoming an independent on Trudeau's team, and this could foreshadow problems ahead, just as we saw in the Chrétien and Martin era. But of course, with this, only time will tell whether the government adopts this path, or if this is the path that Chrystia Freeland is saying that she might go on if she were ever to have the opportunity of becoming Liberal leader.
Yes, it's very interesting to hear these words coming from Chrystia Freeland, given that she is probably the second most powerful person in Canadian federal politics right now after Trudeau, given that she has such a enormous power within the Liberal Party. And to hear this change in doctrine from what the Trudeau government has been peddling for the last 7 years, it's interesting in the implications and also kind of confusing as to how it came about and why now for the shift. And one could take the easy route and point at the Russian-Ukrainian invasion and to mention how that's disrupted all of the economies around the Western world. But the very simple explanation is that Freeland is just saying something because she wants it to appear that she's appealing towards people that want to wean themselves away from Russia and China and the other dictatorships of the world without actually doing anything concrete to actually make that happen. And as we've seen many times before in the past, actors in the Trudeau government have mentioned certain policy declarations and then not really followed them up with any actions. And it's very interesting because this kind of contradicts what Trudeau has done, which is definitely doing an action and then following it up with many different words on why that action is a good thing. Whether it is or not is to be under debate. And, well, we'll find out in the next election whether Trudeau's policies of the last few years have been popular with the Canadian public or not. But it's interesting to see that Freeland is trying to push this form of Canadian economic nationalism, especially when her government has certainly not been pushing for that whatsoever. This is something that, as you said, comes out from more of the conservative playbook, especially from the US, the UK, and around the world, something that would be promoted by Stephen Harper's organization as he develops an alliance of center-right parties and governments around the world and is trying to shape policy to further economic reliance on themselves, especially within NATO, and trying to, as you said, decouple from China and Russia and all of the other emerging dictatorships around the world. So to see Freeland talking about this, it's very interesting that it's come up, but the fact remains that the government hasn't changed their course whatsoever, and we will see later on in the show just how much the government has gone with how they decide to solve this problem.
Yeah, and that's the thing. We always say back up the policy announcement with core actions being taken, and we're not seeing that yet, and this is just what one minister in the government is saying, but it's an absolute rarity to see ministers in the government, let alone the Trudeau government, speak out like this. We always have questions of what could happen to a minister in Trudeau's government if they speak out. It's something that in the past has had huge ramifications for people who do speak out, and we'll be watching to see if this is foreshadowing any potential bumps in the road for the Liberal Party as this goes forward. But we're going to move on to some rather substantial disruptions in British Columbia this week. But before we do that, let me tell you about our Patreon offerings, which you can learn more about at patreon.com/westerncontext, and there you can support the podcast monetarily if you so choose to, for starting as little as $2 a month at the price of a cup of coffee. You'll be helping us remove bias and sensationalism from the news and medium. For $5 a month, you can continue to help us do that and have the name of your support read out on the podcast if you want. And for $10 a month, you can become a Western Context insider and gain an insight into our work and gain pre-release access to our production and show notes throughout the entire week. Now, when we reach $30 a month in contributions, patrons will receive an exclusive monthly news article expanding on the topical stories of the month, and this article will continue to provide the context and information you've come to expect. At $60 a month, you can expect a news and review podcast every other month, where we reflect on the news of the month in a candid way and provide opinion on where affairs might be headed next. And we also do have an option to make a one-time contribution as well via PayPal, which you can learn more about at westerncontext.ca/support. But this week, we had municipal elections in BC, and we have some substantial changes that we're going to talk about right now.
Yes, British Columbians have voted for change as new mayors and council members were elected across the province on Saturday. Now, housing, affordability, public safety, and climate change all influence the way that voters cast their ballots this year, which is, you know, all of the major problems that have been going on in the greater country of Canada as a whole. Now, with BC facing huge inflation costs, a housing crisis, and increasing rates of crime, this means that incumbent mayors and councillors were very hard-pressed to deliver on new actions that would actually address the problems that have come up in their reign since they were elected back in 2018. Now, in some large municipalities such as Kamloops, Victoria, Prince George, and Abbotsford, incumbents chose not to run. But in other cities, including the province's two biggest, incumbents running for re-election lost their jobs to candidates making big claims and running on campaigns of change. Now, whether or not they can actually make good on those promises will be determined over the next 4 years, and it's safe to say that residents will be watching closely to ensure that the people that they support are keeping their word. Now in Vancouver, a completely new turnover of mayor and council occurred as Ken Sim defeated incumbent mayor, former NDP MP Kennedy Stewart, in a rematch of the 2018 election, which saw Stewart win by only 957 votes. And this time, Sim won by almost 86,000 votes to Stewart's almost 50,000 votes. In a clear appetite for change, Sim's entire slate of ABC Vancouver, which stands for A Better City, was also elected to council as well, with no Stewart ally winning. Now, Ken Sim will be the first Chinese-Canadian mayor of Vancouver, where more than 28% of the population has Chinese ethnic origins, according to the 2016 census. Now, tackling public safety and housing is his biggest priority. Sim has promised to hire 100 police officers and 100 mental health nurses to tackle crime in BC's largest city. He also has promised to accelerate permitting in order to address a lack of housing. He has almost also promised to double the number of co-op housing units and has been supportive of plans to increase density, particularly around transit stations. Now, in his victory speech, Sim paid tribute to Chinese-Canadian trailblazers who preceded him, as well as his parents, who he said immigrated from Hong Kong to Canada in 1967 with only $3,200 in the hopes of providing their children a better education and future. And Sim was eventually born and then raised in Vancouver. Now, just to the east, a battle over transit and a municipal police force saw Brenda Locke elected mayor in Surrey, beating incumbent Doug McCallum by just 973 votes. Now, the mayoral race in Surrey was dominated by promises on transit, as well as public infrastructure and the city's ongoing transition from RCMP to a municipal police force, which Locke has promised to reverse if elected. Now, the city began its transition to the Surrey Police Force back in 2018 when council, including Locke, unanimously approved a motion to replace the RCMP. Now, the Surrey Police Union has raised concerns about cost estimates for halting the transition and say that Surrey police officers might not be interested in working for the RCMP. Now, former BC Attorney General Wally Opal, who is the chair of the Surrey Police Transition Task Force, says that going back would be a complicated process, and before the transition could be reversed, approval would be needed from BC's Solicitor General. Now, in Victoria, on the island, when two-term Victoria Mayor Lisa Helps announced that she would not run for the job again this year, eight people, including sitting councillors Stephen Andrew and Marianne Alto, put their race names in the hat to replace her. Now, Alto, who is a businesswoman with a background in law and science, won with about 56% of the votes cast. Now, a key issue in that race was how candidates would vote on the controversial plan to rezone all single-family properties in the municipality of Victoria, which really just accounts for most of downtown, to allow for multi-family add-ons, which is something that the next set of city leaders will decide early on in their term. Now, much of Victoria Council was replaced as well. Only one incumbent councillor actually decided to run for council again, and that was controversial far-leftist Ben Izzet, who has made headlines and into many different Western context shows for his war on Christmas decorations, his disparagement of the Remembrance Day, which he said that the military should pay for, his grifting on paid council lunches, email privacy breaches, and his lunacy while protesting at Ferry Creek, among many, many other things. Now, thankfully, Izzet, who had served in council since 2011, was finally defeated, so he will be no longer be making the headlines for his actions, which have made Victoria Council a mockery in the past. Now, Saanich, which is actually the biggest municipality in the Greater Victoria area, will also be among the municipalities with a new mayor as well, Dean Murdoch, after he narrowly beat one-term incumbent Fred Haynes. Now, the council remains largely the same, and so will the priorities, as the change-up is not going to expect to change a great deal in Saanich. But the real change-up on the island was in Langford, which is one of the largest growing municipalities in the country, as 29-year mayor Stu Young lost to political newcomer Scott Goodmanson. His entire slate of five Langford Now candidates were also elected, and this signifies a huge change for how that part of Greater Victoria may go forward. Lillian Spack, who ran as a independent, was the only incumbent to actually keep her seat, and Spack said that she looks forward to working with the new councillors and acting as a mentor for them. She said of the 29-year tenure of Mayor Stu Young that, quote, he was one of the authors of the change of the community. I think the result, what you see, is a result of having lost touch with that change. I think that's why we have such an upset in Langford. Now, it's also a time for change in BC provincially, as David Eby will become the next Premier of BC and leader of the BC NDP after John Horgan retires, as his only other challenger, Anjali Appadurai, was actually disqualified from the leadership race. Now, Appadurai, who is a former federal NDP candidate, was disqualified late on Wednesday after a report by BC NDP Chief Electoral Officer Elizabeth Cull found that she, quote, engaged in serious improper conduct by working with third parties, including the environmental group Dogwood BC, for membership drives on her behalf. Now, Appadurai and Dogwood deny that any rules were broken. Now, Eby, for his part, says that he'll be listening to the new party members who signed up to support her because of her strong stance on environmental issues. He said, quote, there are a bunch of people out there who are disappointed with how this leadership campaign went. Some may feel they don't have a place in their party. That's not true, and I hope they'll stick around. Right now, my priority is reaching out to those members to recognize the work that she did in engaging them on a really important issue, an issue of priority to me, our province, and government, and to let them know that I will be a leader for all members of the NDP and that climate change is an important issue for everyone in our province. Now, EB, who is 46, was first elected to the BC legislature back in 2013 when he defeated Premier Christy Clark in the riding of Vancouver Point Grey by just over 1,000 votes. Now, Premier John Horgan will be retiring in December, and the date for EB to be sworn in has not been announced yet. Now, Apadurai launched her BC NDP leadership campaign back in August with an emphasis on tackling environmental and human rights issues in what was seen by many as a challenge to the party's status quo and establishment. Now, Horgan said that she could have been a welcome addition to the party, but violating campaign rules wasn't something that the party could overlook. He said, quote, "Enthusiasm and vigor are welcome in the NDP, but you have to follow the rules. This isn't how anyone wanted this race to roll, but I think it's a cautionary tale for all of us." So as we move further into the fall, as the weather has changed from the drought-filled heat into a cool, damp forecast, we will see change politically as many shakeups around this province have occurred, many being quite unexpected, and we'll have to see how this changes things for BC citizens moving forward.
This is a huge shift because, of course, we're talking about the municipal levels here, but a lot of the things that start at the municipal level can work their way up to a provincial and sometimes even a federal level. And this is something that people have to be aware of and keep their eyes open to, because if not, then, well, you could potentially see the BC NDP in such a predicament at some point in the future. You could see the federal NDP or the federal Liberals or any of the parties who represent municipality ridings in BC having a problem electorally in the future as well. And this speaks to a larger change, a change that in most part has been assumed is that consistent progressive leftward push would always be something that would continue in the municipality, specifically the municipalities in BC around the Vancouver area and the Victoria area and on the island and such. But this just shows that there's even a limit to that. And people who thought that was going to be the case and that was the core identity of these areas needs to look at what's happening in here and realize that is not a substantial shift away further down the political spectrum. It's just more a general shift in direction in terms of which way things are going to go. And that's why it's so important to pay attention to, and maybe the incoming premier, David Eby, will realize that, having just effectively been named premier of one of Canada's largest provinces, undemocratically at that. So that's just something else that probably wasn't talked about much this week, is that David Eby was, in effect, undemocratically chosen as premier through that disqualification in the party this week. And we'll have to wait and see if the membership is okay with that, because at the core values, we know that if you look at political parties that do not do what their base wants, well, that can pose problems for the leaders going forward. So we'll just have to wait and see if the base of the BC NDP is happy with the changes made this week.
Yes, it's very interesting to see what's happening with the BC NDP, almost being echoed by the previous federal Conservative leadership campaign, where Trudeau was mocking Pierre Poilievre for basically having a coronation even before the election itself happened. But at least the federal Conservatives actually had an election, and then it was shown without a doubt that Pierre Poilievre was the best candidate to win leadership, as he gained over 68% of the vote there. In this particular case, there was an actual literal coronation, without the crown, because David Eby was actually just acclaimed as leader without any opposition, and the only opposition that he did have was then disqualified by the party. And it seems like it was almost a battle between the establishment and decided to be a further to the left candidate that was trying to challenge the party on its record, especially with the environment and with human rights. And it's very interesting to see, because campaign of Apadurai and her supporters have said that this was the establishment just trying to stop a further to the left candidate from taking over the party and changing its direction, and almost in a sense making it less electable for the next BC election. Whereas, of course, supporters of David Eby have said that that she did break the rules and that she was engaged with the Green Party in trying to get candidates and supporters from both the Green Party, who were actually signed up with the Green Party, to vote in the NDP leadership race. And it's pretty clear that in most leadership elections, you can only hold membership in the party that you're actually voting for the leader for. And so that was certainly a battle between the two different camps there. Now, it could be that, as the truth often is, a bit of both are true and a bit of both are false. But regardless, the end result was, at the end of the day, pretty clear as David Eby is going to be the next leader of the NDP and therefore the next premier. And interestingly enough, we found ourselves in BC in a similar situation to Alberta just next door, where there's going to be a premier who is not elected by the people, but has actually been voted on by party members. And in this particular case in BC, wasn't even voted on. So we're going to be seeing two unelected leaders going into the next election and seeing if they can retain their mandates. And as we saw in BC with the municipal elections in the past week, there's definitely an appetite for change, as it's been said that many governments and at all levels have not done enough for their constituents and their citizens. And definitely in municipal elections, we've seen that there was a lot of change happening, regardless of what side of the political spectrum they were on, given that Kennedy Stewart in Vancouver was definitely very overtly NDP. He got replaced with a Law and Order candidate. And in Langford, we saw a very pro-development, almost conservative mayor who was definitely replaced by a much younger person who has had no experience in politics before and is wanting to change how Langford moves forward. So in all parts of the province, we've seen definitely a lot of change happening. Provincially, though, is much really going to change with David Eby? It's hard to say, but we'll have to see how he approaches politics in BC going forward.
That's right. And of course, with this, it really raises a lot of questions about just what the actual true state of play is. And it's something that everybody relies on the media to hear about, but at so many times the media is only providing their own version of the narrative of what's actually happening. And we're paying very, very close attention to everything happening in Alberta now. We have to, because in all honesty, there's a lot of noise in the media landscape in the province, both in terms of what the reporters are saying, what the government is saying, and that's all getting conflated with one another, and things are bouncing back and forth like a ping pong ball. It's hard to know exactly when it's going to calm down, and that's why we're going to be paying a lot of attention to this, as both the NDP and the UCP have their conventions next weekend, or this weekend rather, and we'll have the results of those conventions next week on the podcast. But the story from Alberta this week has got to be Premier Danielle Smith's new cabinet, despite everything else that popped up in the media this week. And this week continued with continued controversy and media bias regarding comments on Ukraine and Russia. Now, put simply, it's very clear at this point that the media waited until after Smith was elected to publish stories regarding content found on her Locals webpage. And for those not aware, Locals is a Patreon equivalent that has a less restrictive user content policy, and it's become favored by those on the right and those who have views that require a policy like that, because when you look at Patreon's user content policy, it is more restrictive than the Locals' content policy, and that's what the users often sign up for when they go to Locals. Now, the question involved neutrality for Ukraine and support for allowing breakaway regions of a country in that area potentially to join Russia. Now, Smith has since apologized for these comments, calling them ill-informed. She condemned the invasion and pledged to work with outreach groups within the Ukrainian community, and rightly so, because the Ukrainian diaspora in Canada is one of the largest in the world outside of Ukraine. Now, on the topic of neutrality, one of the country's largest papers, often called the paper of record by many in Canada, the Globe and Mail is what I'm talking about, published an editorial piece back in January saying that neutrality had to be the way forward for Ukraine, and they even went as far as citing Austria, which has neutrality enshrined into its post-war constitution, which said that the country would be neutral and in neither sphere of influence during the Cold War. Now, as a reminder to our listeners, editorial boards exist to inform the readers on the position of the specific newspaper chain. And this is what the Globe and Mail was saying in January. Now, they even went as far as talking about President Zelensky's efforts for a peace agreement in March that would have discussed Ukraine's neutrality. And the point about all this is that discussing neutrality, even from the leader of Ukraine, was in vogue at the time when Daniel Smith made these comments. Now, obviously, the war has continued and become more bloody, and civilians have been deliberately targeted by Russia, and the prospect of neutrality should not be entertained by Western leaders today. But, as with most things in the media, the context regarding the comments and what was being discussed in the global press at the time was left out. Now, there remain a great many questions out there about what should be done with Ukraine and if we are doing enough and if NATO should take a larger role or maybe a subset alliance led by the U.S. should take a larger role. And there's also questions on the other side of what the ulterior motives of Russia are, what the ulterior motives of the U.S. are. And as with most conflicts, it's called the fog of war. A lot of people who are doing reporting, a lot of people who are reacting, just don't have all the information to respond and react adequately to what they're talking about. And as a result of this, this results in the context from earlier this year being left out. And this became the main story this week, when in reality, the main story of the week needed to be focused on the announcement of the Smith cabinet and the impending UCP and NDP conventions. As I mentioned, we'll have more on those conventions next week. And for those who were a little bit concerned that the cabinet might, in effect, swap out the Calgary influence for more of a rural influence, the cabinet looks a lot like the cabinet of former Premier Jason Kenney, with a couple notable exceptions. First, Casey Matthew, an Edmonton MLA, is back as Deputy Premier and Minister of Skilled Trades and Professions. Nathan Newdorf joins as a second Deputy Premier, along with being Minister of Infrastructure. And all leadership candidates except Leela Ahir, who is a vocal critic of Danielle Smith, are in cabinet. Travis Taze will return as Finance Minister. Rebecca Schultz is now Minister of Municipal Affairs. Brian Jean is Minister of Jobs, Economy, and Northern Development. Rajan Sani is Minister of Trade, Immigration, and Multiculturalism. Todd Lowen is Minister of Forestry, Parks, and Tourism. And in terms of people who are left out, former Kenny government House Leader Jason Nixon is no longer in cabinet. And also no longer in cabinet, a long-timer, Rick McIver, who was one of the last to serve in the Progressive Conservative cabinets of Jim Prentice and Alison Redford. The biggest ministries, though, of Justice, Health, and Education will be headed up by their former ministers in Jason Cumping, Tyler Shandro, and Adriana LaGrange, respectively. And that's something that the economy will want to see, something that markets will want to see, and something that businesses looking to invest in the province will want to see, that the three of the biggest and most important ministries in the Alberta government remain in the control of those same people who are in their same portfolio. And you can even extend that to Travis Taze as finance minister. The cabinet also, of course, still maintains a heavy Calgary influence with added rural influence, as some were concerned that Calgary's representation would be diminished when Danielle Smith said she wanted to lean more on the rural members of caucus. And if you look at the cabinet in total, it breaks down as follows. There's three from the Edmonton and surrounding region, 13 from Calgary and the surrounding region, and 11 from the rural areas of the province. This cabinet should send a signal to members that an attempt at unity has been made, and the key portfolios did not change, which should ensure investors that and businesses that nothing too drastic will be happening in the future. And Travis Taze even telegraphed this as finance minister, saying that there's discussions going on with legal figures regarding the Sovereignty Act that has put his concerns at bay. Now, this cabinet, of course, caps off a week of speculation and further sensationalism in the media about what might happen in the UCP government without actually waiting to see what the cabinet would look like. And at this point going forward, it's on to the party conventions, which need to be watched with a hawk's eye and determination of what the preparation is going to look like for the 2023 election.
Yes, it's very interesting to see the continued controversy over Danielle Smith this past weekend, the comments that have resurfaced on social media. Definitely when a new person gets elected to a significant post, either Canada or even around the world, definitely the in vogue thing is to go back into their social media accounts and see what type of controversial statements they might have said in the past. And it's just underscoring the dangers of social media and how something that you said in the past when you may have been less informed on an issue can be used against you in the future. And so this is definitely a word of warning for those who engage on social media. But certainly, it's interesting how the media has pivoted to these past comments when there is certainly a lot to talk about that Daniel Smith is doing right now that can affect how Alberta moves forward in the future. And definitely the cabinet announcements is definitely an interesting, given that Smith has wanted to shake up how the party does its business, but she has kept many of the same cabinet ministers in the positions of power that they had before. So it's interesting how, at least in the ministries level, there won't be too much of a shakeup. Rather, the shakeup is going to come from either her leadership style or the priorities that she is going to focus on. And certainly the media is focusing on these past comments on Ukraine. It's interesting to see how the government will actually move forward on issues that are pressing towards Albertans, especially topics like inflation and affordability and jobs that have been something that many Canadians across the country have been concerned about. And we'll see how it goes forward as Danielle Smith gets a bit further into her reign as Premier of Alberta.
Yeah, and in terms of what exactly the future is going to look like, it comes down to what's said at the conventions and who owns the message coming out of the conventions and whose message is able to resonate with the most amount of people. And if that message is able to resonate with those people and carry the party, whether it's the UCP or the NDP, forward into the winter season and into the spring, that of course remains to be seen. But what is said and what is passed at those policy conventions means a lot, and that's where we're going next week with this, but it also underscores how important it is to be able to control the media narrative. And if you can control the media narrative, that's good. But the second thing is control the media narrative with a message that the majority of people who are going to get you elected are going to be able to respond to, in terms of crafting a message that speaks to the majority of people that are having certain issues today in the here and now, not issues as they were a month or 2 months or 2 years ago, so to speak. And that's something that is foreshadowed into the convention, and we'll have to wait and see if this cabinet is able to implement on that and do that as we'd expect them to, because if not, then they could face potential problems as we head into the spring. But, of course, we're going to kind of pivot back to what we talked about with the Freeland Doctrine, the so-called Freeland Doctrine, and look at what Justin Trudeau has to say on the Russian invasion of Ukraine.
Yes, we've seen how Freeland was making comments about the move away from dictatorships and reliance on foreign oil and gas imports, and trying to stop the propping up of China, Russia, and other countries around the world that have autocratic regimes, and trying to promote democracy as the best way of life. And we had to see into the mind of Trudeau as he is speaking, spoke this week at an event at the Climate Change or Canadian Climate Institute, where he had some very interesting comments on the future of Canada and how Canada's natural resources may actually have a shift in the upcoming months because of the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Now, one of the key defenses for the Trudeau government's feeble response to the ever-growing inflation crisis is that Canada is not the only country facing inflation right now. But the problem with this defense is that in the minds of the government, it absolves them of any perceived responsibility for the terrible situation that many Canadians find themselves in these days as a result of failed government policies, just because other countries find themselves in the same boat. Now, the horrifying thing to many Canadians who are experiencing pocketbook challenges because of inflation is that Trudeau actually believes that what he's doing is right and that the path that his government is charting will actually solve the inflation issues that his government has at least partially created. Now, as Pierre Poilievre quipped in a recent question period, can we really trust the arsonists who lit the fire to put it out? Now, in a time of inflation with high oil prices and low unemployment, the government is still running deficits. At a time where investments in natural resources would have paid dividends, when global demand for Canadian energy has never been higher, the government has instead sat by and claimed the opposite. With the Ukraine war having helped to drive Canadian fuel prices to historic highs, Trudeau said that the conflict was actually helping to accelerate this country's shift to renewable energy. Now, while Trudeau acknowledged that the Russian invasion had caused global demand to surge for Canadian sources of LNG and crude oil, he predicted that the net effect would actually be a faster phase-out of the Canadian oil and gas sector. Now, while he was speaking at the event by the Canadian Climate Institute, Trudeau said, quote, "Right now, in the coming couple of years, we're going to need to continue with the mechanisms we have, but the move off of fossil fuels is going to happen much faster because of Russia." And that has made it to our quote of the week because it shows just what Trudeau believes to be true, in that demand for Canadian energy is actually causing a greater shift away from Canadian energy. Now, Russia's February 24th invasion of Ukraine spurred an avalanche of international sanctions that had the effect of cutting off most sources of Russian oil and gas from Western markets. Now, countries such as Canada and the United States even announced that they were banning imports of Russian energy outright, although neither country had ever imported significant shares of Russian petroleum. Where it was actually the case was Europe, especially Germany, which has had to scramble to find alternative sources of energy. And the Trudeau government had promised a moderate increase in Canada's production of oil and gas, but decided that the lack of export infrastructure had sharply limited what could be said overseas. Now, back in March, Natural Resource Minister Jonathan Wilkinson promised that Canada would produce an extra 300,000 barrels per day of fossil fuels, which sounds like a lot, but when you look at it, when it's coming to an entire continent of Europe, it's not going to be very much. Now, however, with Canada having no East Coast ports equipped to actually export either oil or natural gas, all of these exports will have to be done via the United States, which means we have to rely on a foreign power to actually export our own goods, even despite Canada having one of the largest coastlines in the world and having access to both the Pacific Ocean, the Atlantic Ocean, as well as even the Arctic Ocean. Now, Trudeau has previously said that the course is unlikely to change, in keeping with his government's general strategy of discouraging any new oil and gas products or projects that will have the net effect of raising national emissions. Back in August, German Chancellor Olaf Scholz even visited Canada on an explicit mission to call for increased exports of Canadian natural gas. In response, Trudeau told the Germans that there was no business case for Canada to actually sell LNG to Europe, and instead took Scholz to a part of rural Newfoundland that may eventually host a plant that will produce hydrogen from offshore wind power. Now, in case you're thinking that the demand for oil is actually causing a move away from oil, sounds like doublespeak, and is exactly the opposite of what a basic economics textbook says, well, then you'd be right. When foreign leaders come to our country to ask, or not even ask, but beg for help with our resources, not having the capacity to take advantage of such a high demand is a massive wasted economic opportunity at a time when the country really could use it. Now, instead, Trudeau is saying that Canada must remain fiscally responsible in responding to tough economic times as forecasts of a recession grow louder. Now, I know what you're thinking, remaining fiscally responsible, this coming from a government that gave us hundreds of billions of dollars in deficits to account for over $1 trillion in total debt, all in the guise of protecting Canadians from what they call an unprecedented pandemic. Now it's been found that about $200 billion of the $500 billion of debt in the last 2 years actually had nothing to do with spending going towards the pandemic. So for a government to say that they're remaining fiscally responsible amidst their horrible economic record just shows how clueless they actually are in running Canada's economy. Now, Trudeau said that while the Liberals are trying to get inflation relief measures out the door, those supports are targeted. He said, quote, "We know that we need to help people who need help without putting at risk our fiscal stability or contributing further to inflation. That's why remaining fiscally responsible and measured in our response is essential, because we have to prepare for whatever might be coming in the weeks, in the coming weeks and months." Now, former Bank of Canada Governor Mark Carney have also been in the news this week because he warned that Canada and the world are heading towards a recession in the coming months due to several factors. But for those who are looking at Mark Carney, remembering his past as the Bank of Canada governor while he was while Stephen Harper was in power back in the 2008 recession, and found that the Harper government and Carney were able to actually navigate that recession fairly well. Well, for those hoping that the famous Liberal ally would present a change to how the government would tackle the inevitable recession coming up, well, he still backed the Liberal government's current version of fiscal discipline in tackling high inflation. Now back to the real world. On Wednesday, Statistics Canada reported that food prices continued to soar across the country in September, even as the annual inflation rate actually went down to only just a modest 6.9%, which is still way higher than it should be. Now, prices on food purchased from grocery stores continue to soar, rising 11.4% to a new 41-year high. Now, last month, shoppers paid more for meat at 7.6%, dairy at 9.7%, bakery goods at 14.8%, and fresh vegetables at 11.8%. This is just over a month's time. So as we see from this, Canada just got out of the dark times of the past few years, and now it seems we're headed for a new, different set of dark times in the next 2 years. All because our Prime Minister thinks that he's being fiscally responsible and that the world doesn't want Canadian resources.
And this story illustrates the huge black and white difference between what Chrystia Freeland and Justin Trudeau are saying in terms of how they view the Canadian economy. One is viewing the Canadian economy looking forward in terms of how that economy is going to interact with supply chains, with our industry, with the industries of our allies, and the other here is pursuing the same policies that we've seen for the last 7 years, the policies that have led to that huge increase in government spending, even before the pandemic, and we'll underscore that, even before the pandemic, there was a huge increase in government spending, which bankers at the time did warn would be a recipe for inflation if the Central Bank of Canada had to lower interest rates, which they did. And we're seeing the results of that now. And it's quite interesting to look at this because this is a classic Western context firing line, because we have, of course, Chrystia Freeland, and then we have Justin Trudeau on one side, but it's only through this podcast, through both of the stories this week in terms of covering what each of them are talking about, that we're actually able to get some kind of picture of what's going on in the country. And nobody in the media has done that yet. And that's why this was our firing line this week, and why Canadians should be viewing the top two positions in the government, the Prime Minister and the Deputy Prime Minister, who is also the Finance Minister, with a greater level of scrutiny than they did last week.
Yes, indeed, especially given Trudeau's comments in a very liberal-friendly forum. It's very interesting to see the double speak that's on display, saying that there's no business case for Canadian resources, even as foreign leaders are coming to the country to try and get more and more of those resources, to get them away from Russian fuel sources. Or, you know, as we see that the government is trying to say that they're being fiscally responsible, even as they pushed Canada's national debt over $1 trillion when it was less than half of that, less than a third of that, actually, before Trudeau even took power back in 2015. Definitely the fiscal discipline is definitely being defined differently by our federal government as it is by anyone who actually knows anything about economies and economics. And certainly there's a different juxtaposition from what we saw from Chrystia Freeland and what we continue to see from Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. It's very interesting to see the different mental math that's on display from the Prime Minister as he describes the fiscal discipline that's been on display. And we definitely see the juxtaposition between the Liberals and the Conservatives, with Pierre Poilievre noting, can we really trust the arsonists who lit the fire to end up putting it out, referring to the inflation fire that the government spending has continued to add towards. And, you know, we're just seeing the different worldviews on display here. And at the end of the day, Canadians are paying the price from this indecision as inflation is still going up. And even though it's not as bad as it was back in the summertime, it's still really bad. And food prices are still continuing to climb at astronomical rates. And at the end of the day, it's Canada and Canadians that are paying the price for our government's inaction on being able to develop the economy properly.
Yeah, and anybody who's been to a grocery store recently will be 100% aware of everything that was mentioned in terms of the prices going up and questioning why that's not the focus of more governments when it needs to be the focus at this point in time, lowering those prices. And unfortunately, the way it's likely going to go is that it will end up happening through a recession, and even in recessions, things don't always go back to how they were when we've seen month over month huge periods of inflation, and it's just going to have a negative effect going forward at some point. And the ones who suffer at the end of the day are Canadians, and we'll just have to look to see what happens if they make any different decisions as the next elections start rolling forward. But with that, we can move on to our word of the week.
Yes, our word of the week this week is turnover, which is defined as the number of people hired within a period to replace those leaving or dropped from a workforce. Now, certainly there has been a lot of turnover in the municipal elections as many incumbents had left that particular workforce and are now being replaced by people that are trusted by voters to chart a different path and tackle the issues that are facing British Columbians and certainly Canadians as a whole. And turnover could mean any other number of different definitions, but certainly we're seeing a lot of turnover in BC. We'll see if we're seeing a lot of turnover in Canada as well, and definitely in Alberta with different changes to the cabinet, but much of the same people that are remaining in charge in Daniel Smith's Alberta and UCP cabinet. So turnover here and there, we'll see if much of that turnover will actually produce the change that is being required by its citizens.
That's right. And this is something that we've been watching this entire week. And this is an episode of Western Context that touches on many different things and connected many different dots that you probably haven't have heard about this week in the media. And if you want to go back on any of these, we have full show notes available at westerncontext.ca. You can subscribe to the podcast on your favorite podcast listener. Just visit westerncontext.ca/subscribe and click on your favorite one. We're on Apple Podcasts, Google Pocket Casts, Spotify, and more. Just visit westerncontext.ca/subscribe. And we're also on Twitter and Facebook at Western Context, where we share the shows and some of the stories that we're looking at throughout the entire week. So with that being said, we'll be back next week for another episode of Western Context.
And we'll be sure to look through all the stories that the mainstream media is talking about and a lot that they aren't talking about, and uncovering what the real stories are of the week and how they actually matter to Canadians. We'll find these, whether they're in radio, TV, print, or online. We will find them and we'll give you the context needed to put yourselves on the right side of the news. So with that said, we'll be back next week for another episode of Western Context.